Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of Legion of News is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
From high atop the Milkpacking District to the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon, this, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
Bean sprouts are killing people in Germany. Zombies protest Wisconsin governor's budget cuts, and an Oregon cat has the bubonic plague.
As always, my friend, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Friday, June 10th, 2011. A cat in Prineville, Oregon, has been diagnosed with bubonic plague, the fourth case reported in Oregon among people and animals since January of last year. Christine Stone of the Oregon Health Authority says the cat has been treated with antibiotics and is recovering. Stone says two people were diagnosed with the bubonic plague last year and one dog, all survived. The bacteria that caused the disease is spread to humans with flea bites. Stone said untreated cases can be fatal, but early treatment with antibiotics cures the infection. According to the OHA, bubonic plague cases are rare in Oregon, and flea treatment for household pets can help prevent its spread. A veterinarian with OHP said, plague is spread to humans through a bite from an infected flea. People can protect themselves, their family members, and their pets. Using flea treatment on your pets is very important because your pets can bring fleas into your home. Plague is serious, but it is treatable with antibiotics if caught early. Dogs cannot develop the disease, but they can carry infected fleas. So far, only three human cases have been diagnosed since 1995 in Oregon, and none of them resulted in deaths. This is the first pet diagnosis in 15 years.
That's going to be the whole branch of cyborg porn that I develop. The study of bubonics.
Oh, bubonics.
See what I did there?
Right. Or it could be about ghosts.
Now, see, that was the joke that I considered earlier. What disease do ghosts, you know, get most often? Bubonic plague. And then I thought anything that comes off a package of Laffy Taffy is a thing that I'm going to eschew today. I'm glad you were there to pick it up for me, though.
Well, sure. Because I have no such qualms about just reaching for the low-hanging fruit.
You're looking very sparkly today.
Oh, you're covered
with sequins.
Yes. I'm like a...
What's happening later?
Nothing.
Really?
Yeah, no.
Was it just for me?
The sequins weren't really my idea. They just sort of came on the shirt.
Is it just something you've spilled on yourself?
No, not for a change. No, it's not.
Okay.
No, this is one of these. Patrick calls this my hippie shirt.
You look like a sequin-covered chiffon.
Yeah, no, it's just that it's one of the few things I have that isn't black and long-sleeved, completely long-sleeved and warm. So since it's going to be warm today, I thought I would wear something that was light and cottony and flowy.
When is the warmth going to be happening?
Because
it's already the middle of the day.
I've been sweating like 2 days. It could just be that,
menopause.
You know, because I'm old and menopausal,
right.
Too. I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no internal temperature control system. Which is why everything I own is just black and looks like a sweatshirt.
It's all just gone haywire inside.
Yes, so.
Okay. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. It is Friday, June 10th, 2011. Coming up later on this hour, Science in the March. Also, your entertainment news. Don't forget, if you want to get this program later on the day via iTunes, you can do that. It's also available as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com. You can also take it with you on your mobile device. That is mobile.cascadia.fm and the Rick Emerson Show coming up next hour. Today we'll have the top five from December 8th, 1973 for no readily apparent reason. Also, Mr. Big Jim Willig in the studio with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Today talking about the life and work of Mr. John Candy. That is all coming up next hour at rickemersonshow.com. Here is Don Taylor.
About 20 protesters dressed as zombies showed up at a torch run for the Special Olympics in Madison, Wisconsin.
Who protests the Special Olympics?
Well, they weren't really protesting the Special Olympics.
Okay.
They were basically just trying to show their opposition to Governor Scott Walker's budget because he was speaking at the Special Olympics ceremony on the state capitol grounds.
That seems really ill-timed. Somebody didn't look at their calendar closely enough.
Well, yeah, apparently the protesters were part of a larger group of protesters who had spent the day earlier marching on the capitol grounds, protesting Walker's cuts to higher education funding and a new voter ID law. Except that some of these students who had organized a protest earlier in the day, who went dressed as zombies, decided they would just wander over to the Special Olympics since he was going to be there too.
Oh, so unfortunate.
Yeah, and so they said they didn't want to offend the Special Olympics.
So you've got a bunch of staggering, tripping, stumbling people.
Yes.
Who are sort of schlepping themselves over the Special Olympics going, "Arr!"
Yes.
Okay, but no offense was intended.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
The Wisconsin Vice President of Communications for the Special Olympics, Kelly Klopping, said, "We expected that some protests would occur, but they weren't really expecting people to show up, you know."
No,
because that just zombies.
That seems like an unfortunate juxtaposition.
Yes, someone commenting on a Madison, Wisconsin news station website wrote, "Regardless of whether you like Scott Walker or not, this was very rude."
It really does seem unfortunate. Like, it seems like Arrested Development unfortunate.
Yeah.
That's great. Excellent. Well done.
Yeah, Governor Walker's a spokesman said that he thought it was unfortunate that the protesters chose that venue.
Awesome. You are listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Coming up next hour, the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Coming up in like 3 seconds, Don Taylor at the news desk.
And here I am now.
Excellent.
The origin of a deadly bacterial outbreak that has killed at least 27 people in Europe has been traced to bean sprouts in Germany. Reinhard Berger, with the Robert Koch Institute, said through a translator that they did a statistical study to determine which food was responsible.
The people who ate the bean sprouts had a nine times a higher risk to get this diarrhea.
That's great that it all just ended on that word. That's wonderful that was really the whole point of that was just to get to the word diarrhea at the end.
Through the translator, Reinhard Berger said that it was traced to bean sprouts.
It is the bean sprouts, but we don't know exactly where they come from.
That's great. You know, just from now on, though, I'm just going to, for whatever it is we need, I'm just going to use the Richard Dreyfuss as, I'm just going to use the Richard Dreyfuss as Hitler. Bed. Let's see if I have the,
License is effective until terminated.
Which is wonderful. I can't tell you the number of people that I played that for, yesterday. That I was just so agog that it hadn't made its way all across the entire internet that I subjected numerous people to that.
I'm just sorry that Christopher Walken didn't think of it first.
Yeah, well, yeah. What are you gonna do? All right.
Governor John Kitzhaber has signed a bill revamping Oregon's bottle deposit system. The bill was signed yesterday and will make the deposit system apply to just about any glass, metal, or plastic beverage container, effective by 2018. The existing law requires a deposit for plastic water and soda bottles, but not for nearly identical iced tea bottles. Two Hood River High School seniors played a big role in the bottle bill law. Alex Milton and Ali Denko testified as experts on the bottle bill redemption experience after collecting containers from the Hood River area for more than 2 years. They sorted about 220,000 bottles and cans and raised around $11,000 for local charities. Ali Denko said, a lot of people are really confused about what they can recycle and what they can redeem, so I think this bill will just help raise awareness and increase recycling.
I don't understand the whole notion of a deposit. What am I depositing? And with whom?
Well, when you buy anything that comes in a recyclable bottle,
right,
there's actually a deposit tax that's
not a
tacked
can,
onto it.
Just a bottle.
I think so. I'm okay. Not sure. Basically, whenever you recycle something for money, if you take one of these things to a can deposit place and you get 5 cents back,
right,
you're basically getting back your 5 cents that you already paid when you bought the thing.
Who's giving me the 5 cents?
Well, if you take it to a place and you get the money yourself.
Right, but I'm saying, where's that 5 cents coming from?
Well,
you're the recycling guy. I get a can. I bring it in. Here you go, here's your can. You go, here's 5 cents. Where did you get that 5 cents from? If you run a recycling place, Dawn's Recycling, I bring in a can.
Right.
Let's say I bring in 1,000 cans, and you got to give me 1,000 times, 5 cents. Where are you getting that money from?
I'm probably getting it from selling all of that to a smelter.
So, but
who then will buy the aluminum from me?
Are you then, are you required to give me that?
Well, no, but I think what happens is, and someone may correct me about this, but I think what happens is you pay the deposit when you buy something that comes in a can or a bottle.
Right.
That goes to the state, which helps to fund all the recycling programs. You have the option of either, recycling your stuff at the curb if that's available to you, donating it to someone, collecting like tons of it and selling it directly to the aluminum place yourself, taking it to one of these can machines at Fred Meyer or something, which are owned by individuals who will pay you. Basically, you're getting back money you've already paid, but the money you're paying, I think, is going to the state to help fund recycling.
Now, why isn't everything like this, though? In other words, why do they give me a nickel for a bottle, do you suppose, and not for a can?
I know that you get something back for cans, but I'm really not sure what.
Is that true?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I don't know. But for some reason, one of the things they're saying is specifically the existing law requires a deposit for water and soda bottles, but not for iced tea.
Because that makes sense.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that they're fixing.
I wonder what their motivation was for all of this. I mean, are they just trying to get like a Weebelo badge or something? Or
they're also saying that if redemption, like you are returning things and such and not throwing it in the trash, if that falls below 80% for 2 consecutive years, they're going to raise the nickel deposit to a dime.
Are they somehow claiming that people don't know what they can recycle?
Well, in essence, yes, because
there's a huge label on the side that says recycle this.
Yeah, but there's other things, though. It's like if you turn over any kind of a plastic bottle, a milk bottle,
right,
any kind of a container, you'll see that little plastic symbol and it has a number in
right.
it. Some of those things are recyclable. Some of them are not. Some trash people will take certain recyclables and not others. I mean, particularly with plastics, it can get kind of complicated with figuring out with a lot of these things. I think with the milk containers or maybe some others, the bottle is recyclable, but the lid isn't.
It's too confusing.
You're not supposed to put the lid in the. Yeah, it is very confusing, and I think that's part of what they're trying to. And then some stuff you get money back, some stuff you don't.
This is why I have no faith in recycling, by the way. If I'm taking in a milk jug, and somehow with our vast 21st century knowledge, we can recycle the jug but not the plastic cap. Like, that just defeats all of our abilities, then the whole system has just got to be fundamentally flawed.
Well, I think it's a thing that they have to put certain chemicals in the caps because they're harder. Because the milk bottle itself is actually
right,
kind of soft,
yeah.
So it's gonna melt differently. Yeah, it's all really screwed up.
That I disbelieve all of that. We transplanted a guy's face the other day. I mean, seriously. Like, turn the heat up higher in the recycling thing. I mean,
but that might burn the softer plastic.
By the way, someone has got my back on this. Somebody says, these people are stupid. You've been able to redeem all these things for a nickel for like 30 years. Even bums figured this out.
You say that, sir, but if you have ever stood there feeding things into one of these machines and then it just randomly kicks something back out and goes, oh, I'm sorry, I won't take the Snapple bottle. Yeah. And you're going, but now what do I do with it?
That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Yeah, see, I guess I've never used the machine. I guess whenever I've recycled, I've just taken it to a place where there's a guy.
Yes.
And I just give it to him. And anyway, he like puts it on a scale and goes, that'll be 14 cents. And then he hands me my 14 cents and I go home.
And then, you spend $1.50 to drive back home.
Yeah, so I quit doing that, actually. So instead, I just take it up to the curb, and then the trash guy comes and takes it away.
Or the hobos.
Well, that's the thing about it, is, like, this is why I have no moral problem about just throwing all my aluminum cans in the trash, which I do, by the way, every single day. Because they'll either be taken away by the trash guy, or more likely they will be taken away by the bums. But it's like whether or not the homeless guys pick them out of my trash, you know they're not going to make it to the landfill. Like, at some point between my house and the landfill, the homeless will descend and the homeless will sort through them like carpenter ants, and they will, you know, or leaf cutter ants, and they'll just take away all the aluminum stuff. Like, the sorting happens whether you do it at the curb or whether you do it, you know, like 10 miles from my house. You know, winos will come and do that work for you.
Yeah, Patrick and I, when we lived in North Portland, which is a fine, fine portion of our city, discovered that the best way for us to get rid of our cans and bottles was just to leave them in a bag on our back porch.
Yeah, well, that's what Laura does with...
Not our front porch, which anybody in the world could just walk right up to. No, if we left it on the front porch, no one would touch it. If we put it on the back porch, where somebody had to hop our fence and steal them, well, then they would disappear.
On the front porch, they figure that you're getting ready to leave the house and you're going to be picking that up on the way to the car. Yeah. And they don't want to, you know, they don't want to cross you like that.
Plus, the deposit nickels are so much sweeter if they're from stolen bottles and cans.
Exactly. That's money stolen is twice as sweet as money earned, Don. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Coming up later in the hour, Science on the March. Also, your entertainment news that is coming up later on this hour. Here is Don Taylor.
Put that one aside for later because I don't know where it's from.
Okay.
A 21-year-old British man was forced to flee half-naked from an attacker after he woke up in a strange house with no memory of how he got there. The victim had been at the Darwin Beer Festival. The last thing he remembered was drinking at the Bridgewater Pub. He woke up in an unknown house hours later when confronted by a man who punched him as he tried to leave. A member of the public contacted police after spotting him on Cemetery Road wearing only jeans and socks. The caller was concerned for his safety because he was wandering along the street. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Lancashire police are appealing for help in establishing how he got into the house, where it was, and what happened to him. A spokesperson described it as a very unusual case.
You know what else is unusual is that there is a Cemetery Road. I mean, don't you think at some point somebody... I mean, even then, when they named it that, it must have seemed morbid. I can't imagine that seemed like a cheery name for something, like even in, like, 1750.
There was a time, though, when people were not particularly clever about naming things. I mean, if you look around here in the Portland area, you know, how many things do we have, like Boone's Ferry Road?
Pile of Dirt Avenue.
Yeah, it's like, it's Bank Street. You know, people just would go, well, where does this road go? Well, it goes down to the ferry. Okay, we'll call it Ferry Road.
Yeah, I guess. So there's a, on the way back from my hometown, you have to drive right, but one of the main roads that you have to go down, so-called main roads you have to go down before you get to the highway is Coffin Road. And it's, you know, and ever since I was a child, I used to ask my dad, like, why is it called Coffin Road? And he's like, because people die here all the time. And it was, I guess it was like, it was sort of a dead man's curve kind of a thing.
And in reality, it was probably named after somebody whose name
John
was like
Coffin.
Jacob Coffin or
yeah,
something.
So I've always been amazed that nobody has called their band Coffin Road, though. So, you know, there seems like there ought to be some sort of a...
like a Springsteen song.
Seriously, some sort of a Kennewick psychobilly band or something. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Here is Don Taylor.
Starbucks will start selling beer and wine at its newest location in the Pearl District. Regional Director Andrea Streetane said, "We do know that 75% of our customers do come in before 2 p.m., so for us this is a great way to expand into the afternoon and evening day part." Evening day part?
Into the afternoon alcoholic demographic.
Yes. Starbucks already has 3 stores that sell alcohol in Seattle. But this new location will be the first for Portland. It's located at 1039 Northwest Cooch Street.
She said day part?
Yeah, that was the part of a great way to expand into the afternoon and evening day part.
That's interesting, because day part's a radio term.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, day part is a section of the day.
Oh.
It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a part of the day. So you say, like, your morning drive is, that's the day part in which ad rates are the highest.
So then you would have an evening day part.
Yes.
Oh, Interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a weird sort of clunky term, but that is a term that I have only ever heard in radio. But it might have filtered into the rest of the marketing world. But it's just the one location?
So far, yes.
And it's in
the Pearl.
Not that it really matters to me, because I don't really go to Starbucks, nor am I going to go drink wine at Starbucks. But I mean,
It's going to have this sort of industrial sort of feel to try and blend into all the other hoo-ha at the Pearl District.
To blend into the hoo-ha.
Some of the fixtures were picked from local salvage yards. The main counter was made out of a fallen tree from a farm in Oregon City. And in an homage to Portland's biking community, an entire wall was made from inner tubes.
Can have an entire wall just made of spray-painted bikes that were, that belong to people run down by wine enthusiasts.
Yeah. They're going to offer Rogue, Widmer, and Deschutes beer. And I would like to alert whoever wrote this at KGW, you should keep in mind that the words Rogue and Rouge are very close together.
Did they type Rouge beer?
Yes. That's Rouge, Widmer, and Deschutes will
fantastic.
Be served.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. Excellent.
Assistant Brewmaster Ryan Schmiggy for Deschutes said, it can help introduce people who are in mainstream larger company who maybe don't experience the smaller brands. It can bring those smaller brands like ours to them. Yes, because I'm sure there are many people who live in the Pearl who are going to Starbucks who aren't aware that we have smaller breweries in Portland.
See, you were going that way, and I was going the whole, Schmiga likes microbrews.
Anyway, the new Starbucks store will be open on June 13th at 5 a.m., but you won't be able to get beer or wine until 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay, but you could roll out of bed at like 1:30 and still make it down there in time to get your drink on.
Yeah, and if you like live in the Pearl, you could just put on your $600 cargo shorts, and just sort of walk up the street and get yourself a beer at the Starbucks, because, there's no actual pubs or beer emporiums in the Pearl District.
Can they have a special kind of beer that's brewed like for 5 times longer than it ought to be and has a brackish bitter aftertaste to it? That would be wonderful.
I'm trying to figure out, I can understand why Starbucks would do this, but if you're going to choose a location to do this, why are you going to do it in a neighborhood that already has plenty of places where you could go get a beer?
Because I would imagine that's also the place where people are most likely to go to a Starbucks, as opposed to Southeast Portland. And I would—it's also a place that has the most disposable income, as opposed to Southeast Portland.
And I guess you can't.
And you can charge $9 for a beer there, and people will pay it.
And you can like drink with your kids.
I mean if you tried to do that on like 50th and Hawthorne or something, people would just you'd get kicked. I mean, there is a reason that the further you get from downtown Portland and the further you get from the suburbs, the fewer Starbucks there are.
I'd be interested to know what the OLCC layout is for this place, because one of the things, if you don't live here in Portland, you may not be aware, we have this thing called the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which is like this weird state mafia that controls all of the liquor and the alcohol and the beer. But the thing is, they also, their inspectors go and then they tell you what hours you can serve booze and what section of the place minors have to stay out of. And it all seems very arcane and whimsical based on whoever the inspector is who goes to the place and what kind of mood they were in when they got there. Because there's no consistency for these rules anywhere in town. And so I'm imagining Starbucks being Starbucks, they can, I'm not saying that any palms were greased, but they can arrange to have the most optimal experience for their customers in their store. But since there's so many places in town where anywhere that alcohol is being served, minors are not allowed, or they're not allowed in that half of the restaurant or whatever, how are you going to have a Starbucks where you're serving beer and wine after 2 p.m. without designating, no minors?
Well, there might be like a half of the Starbucks where you can't go. There might be like a beer garden area.
Maybe.
They could sort of cordon it off, or this side is alcohol serving only. You know what I didn't know is that I didn't know you, and this sounds retarded, but I didn't know you can't have babies in bars in Oregon, because in a lot of states you can. When I was a younger person in Washington State, you could actually take children to bars until they became, I think, 3 years of age. Then you couldn't take them in. But Kelly Clark was trying to do like a pub crawl the other day with her baby, and apparently they were like, no, you can't have a baby in here. And she goes, why can't, which is, the, and then, which, this is then great, why can't I have it here? It's just a baby. And then, which is sort of wonderful when you say it out loud, the idea that it had to be explained why she couldn't be taking an infant to a series of bars with Aaron Mesh. But apparently it's that they explain that a baby is not yet 21, and is a yes. minor, or as her husband put it, really like a hella minor, and so you, it's not a thing that's allowed. No, the ULCC hasn't, there's no consistency. It doesn't make any sense at all, but what is consistent is Starbucks just deciding that if one addictive substance sells really well, why not sell, like, more than one addictive substance?
Ooh, they should have Starbucks hookah lounges.
I was going to say, they just have a thing where you just go in and they just, you know, you just hook like a nicotine syringe up to yourself. You are listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
A federal jury is expected to begin deliberations today at the retrial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Yeah.
Thursday, after closing arguments, Blagojevich told reporters it's taken a long time to get to where he is today.
Let's see. This is...
Trial.
Trial. Hold on. Let's see. The hell is my Blagojevich sound? All right.
It's been a long and very difficult journey for Patty, for our daughters, Amy and Annie, and for me, of course. I've waited 2.5 years to finally get a chance to get on the witness stand and tell the truth. And to take as long as it takes to answer every question as honestly and as fully as possible.
Here's the thing about Rob Blagojevich. You look at that guy, and he seems like sort of a shady alternate universe Mike Russell. You know?
Yeah.
If Mike Russell
had the world's worst comb over.
Yeah, like if he were just as, like if Mike Russell were not to be as he is, you know, in our dimension, in our reality, you know, as sort of, you know, fantastic cartoonist and whimsical pundit and a skilled writer and amusing individual and all around good guy. But if he were instead to be what my grandfather would call a schnook, he would absolutely be Rod Blagojevich.
And also, here's a clue for people like Blagojevich or Donald Trump or even people in the private sector. If you're losing your hair, just giving yourself giant fluffy bangs that just spray into place so it's a hard shelf covering your entire forehead, it's not fooling anybody.
See, I think Blagojevich has got the full head of hair as opposed to Trump. Trump's got the weird cross-hatching thing that he does where it's somebody on the... like somebody on Gawker or somebody, they get like a really high res, like a Google Earth photograph of Donald Trump's head. It was like, it was amazing though. It was like sort of this weird cross lacing that was, I mean, it was like the top of Trump's head all looked like that little cross hatch on the side of Archie Andrews' head. You know, where there's just like, it's like it's a little tic-tac-toe board of hair where somebody had clearly taken it and it really was like they had just weaved. It was like making, it was like the Chinook Indians making like a thatched rug out of reeds or something, or like those Amazonian tribes that make an island out of reeds and they just float on the river. And that's what the top of Trump's head looked like.
It's like the woven back of an old rocking chair.
Exactly. That's totally what it is. I think Blagojevich might actually have, but again, he doesn't have hair like Mike Russell. Mike Russell has a perfect head of hair.
He does. Mike Russell has excellent
His hair is excellent. It's flawless.
Blagojevich told reporters it's been a long 2.5 years to get to this point.
With only prostitutes to console
You himself. Wake up on the morning of December the 8th, 2008, and you're the governor of the fifth biggest state in America, and pretty much everybody calls you back, and pretty much you got a lot of friends. And then this happens to you the next morning, December the 9th, 2008, and then nobody calls you. And those people you thought were your friends are, for a lot of different reasons, no longer what you thought they were. It's a very lonely time.
It's like some sort of Damon Runyon governor.
Oh, Rod, you never had any real friends.
No, it's true.
Yeah. Let's do science news.
Here's your Science on the March for Friday, June 10th, 2011, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find out more about them at squireselectric.com or facebook.com/squireselectric. You can also call if you like. It's 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. And by easier, I mean they can come there, they can make sure that something is done right the first time and that you're not going to... Do you remember the I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffler slogan?
Yes.
That's a thing that I reference sometimes and people look at me and they blink. They do the slow Homer Simpson blink and it's like they don't know what I'm talking about. And it's not. I mean people my own age. Hmm. I'll say, I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffler. And then it's just sort of a... sound where just nothing happens.
I don't remember who that was. That Midas?
No, it was in fact it was an East Coast company. I believe it was like the King Muffler Company. Okay. Or something. But it was a muffler company that I think didn't actually even exist here on the West Coast. It was like it was some chain that was in New York. But we all kind of learned that slogan. I learned it from Letterman because Letterman used to drop the "I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffler thing"
That's
all
right.
the time. What was my point? Anyway, blah, 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 not going to pay a lot, blah, 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 electrical inspecting, blah, 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 yada, yada. In any event, you can contact them at 503-252-1609 or at squireselectric.com. You can also find them online at facebook.com/squireselectric. While you are there, do yourself and us a favor if you just give them a little bit of a like there on Facebook. That would be fantabulous. You can also see some unsolicited testimonials from customers. People have had them come out to their home or to their business, and they've done upgrades, they've done repairs, they've done installation. Or if you've got an inspection coming up, you can make sure that you're going to pass it by having Squires Electric do your pre-inspection. And you can sleep content and warm, secure in the bosom of knowledge that you, yes, you, are helping to support the Legion of News family and the Rick Emerson Show gaggle of folks.
Oeuvre. No, that doesn't work.
It's a thing like that. Really, you're helping them give us money. I mean, that really is what it comes down to. It's 503-252-1609. They are the proud sponsors of this, your Science in the March. They're Squires Electric. Here's Dawn Taylor.
A pair of NASA probes wandering in deep space discovered that the outer edge of the solar system contains curious magnetic bubbles and is not as smooth as was previously thought, according to astronomers. The NASA Voyager twin spacecraft, which launched in 1977, are currently exploring the farthest outlays of the heliosphere, where solar wind is slowed and warped by pressure from other forces of the galaxy. NASA said, because the sun spins, its magnetic field becomes twisted and wrinkled, a bit like a ballerina's skirt. That is astronomer Mirav Ofer of Boston University. He said, far, far away from the sun, where the Voyagers are, the folds of the skirt start to bunch up. The Voyagers are almost 10 billion miles from Earth in a little-known boundary region where solar wind and magnetic field are influenced by material expelled from other stars in our corner of the Milky Way galaxy. This turbulent sea of magnetic bubbles, as they called it, occurs when parts of the sun's distant magnetic field break up and reorganize under pressure. The bubbles are about 100 million miles wide, meaning the Voyager probes could take multiple weeks to cross a single one of them.
Seriously, when we were broadcasting on KPAM, it was like there were places like a mile away where if you went behind a tree, you couldn't get the signal for the radio station. And Voyager's like 10 million miles away,
yes,
you know, on the other side of space. And it's just sending us back just information left and right. I don't understand how anything works.
Yeah. Apparently, we used to believe, and by we, I mean, you know, scientists, not me. We believed that the sun's distant magnetic field curved in a relatively graceful arc, eventually folding back to rejoin the sun. But they now, from the photos they're seeing, realize that the region is actually, they say, bubbly and frothy. So the actual bubbles appear to be self-contained and substantially disconnected from the broader solar magnetic field. The findings were made using a new computer model to analyze data from the craft and are published in the June 9th edition of the Astrophysical Journal.
It's like a solar meringue.
A little bit.
Okay.
Yes, it's like... It's like the froth on the top of your cappuccino.
It's like the...
Only 100 million... Each bubble is 100 million miles wide.
Hey, do they have to use like a little stencil thing to make the little leaf pattern on top of the coffee?
No.
Really? Do they just do that?
No, that's... Yeah, no, that's a specialized skill that basically when you pour the... You put the milk on first and then you pour the cappuccino... Pour the espresso through the milk.
Right.
And then through the way that you actually pour it in... You may, and sometimes they'll like drag a spoon through it. There is actually kind of a small and rather lame art to making the designs on top of the foam.
You know, one of the things about being me and being low maintenance is that I prefer not to have food that is designed or decorated that looks like something, because then I don't have to feel any guilt when I destroy it. Thank you for the art.
Yeah, I have this thing where I remember when I first read a few years ago that they have these national barista competitions.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things is foam art. And I was like, really? And at the time, I didn't even know anyone did that, because when I was working at Starbucks, we certainly didn't care. And plus, most people get their stuff with a plastic lid on it.
Right.
And now I've gone to places every once in a while where I order a cappuccino and they give it to me and they've done some little pattern on the top. And I just immediately, I just kind of like go, oh, that's cute and unnecessary.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, thanks.
But it's a little extra, you know.
I always feel like maybe I'm supposed to be more impressed with it than I am, because it is a skill someone had to learn how to do.
But that's true with all food preparation. Just put it in a bucket. I don't care. You know, it's like when you go, like, have you ever, like, you go to some upscale, you know, joint, it's like and there's the guy who does that the thing with the sauce, where he has the sauce and then he has like a long toothpick and he's going, and he goes back and forth and he like streaks the sauce into like a little sort of series of jagged line, and you're like, I don't care. Just give me the steak. You know, which I know makes me a rube or whatever, but I like food preparation that makes zero impact on me.
See, a lot of food preparation I really appreciate. A lot of extra customer service stuff I really appreciate. This morning I had to be on the phone because I just moved, so I had to be on the phone with PG&E and Comcast. And in both cases, the people I had to deal with were awesome. It's like I think big companies are now realizing we're also pissed off all the time, that they need to really step up their customer service. But so that stuff I really appreciate, and I think about it. It's like, thank you, sir, for not being an ass. That was awesome. But the foam on the cappuccino with the pattern, every time I see it, I just sort of feel like this is wasted on me, because this is not making my life any better. It's not.
It makes them happy.
It's not making my cappuccino experience any better.
Maybe it puts a spring in there. So maybe it lifts the corners of their heart, Dawn, to bring a little, to create a little bit of art, even if you don't appreciate it.
And it makes them, you know, feel like they're an accomplished, skilled person.
Even if you just callously destroy their beauty.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that. They're doing it for them, not
yes,
for me.
Yes, that's right. No.
The hottest summer day you can remember from childhood could be the norm in a few decades. In fact, it looks like the heat has already been cranked up. Noah Diffenbaugh, an assistant professor of environmental earth systems science at Stanford, said, "When scientists talk about global warming causing more heat waves, people often ask if that means the hottest temperatures will become the new normal. That got us thinking. At what point can we expect the coolest seasonal temperatures to always be hotter than the historically highest temperatures of the season?" Diffenbaugh is lead author of a study to be published later this month in the journal Climate Change. Stanford research assistant Martin Scherer co-authored. He said, according to our projections, large areas of the globe are likely to warm up so quickly that by the middle of the century, even the coolest summers will be hotter than the hottest summers of the past 50 years.
You know that the Earth used to be molten, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Saying
the hottest summer on record seems a little disingenuous.
Well, the hottest summers of the past 50 years, which is we have actual records for.
But see, that's a bit... Okay, fine.
Within the next 20 to 60 years, if greenhouse gas levels continue to rise, summer temperatures are likely to rise irreversibly around the globe, with the tropics feeling the heat first and parts of Africa, Asia, and the Americas suffering unprecedented summer heat within the next two decades.
Also, I should point out that something can't be the new normal. If something is new, it is by definition not normal. If something is new, it is a recent development, which means it is an aberration from what has traditionally been the case, so it's not normal.
It could be the new average, but not the new normal.
Well, I guess, but that's only if you are calculating the average by using only the period in which that new thing is happening. Because if you start adding other stuff to it, you get a different outcome, which means it's not the average. If today's temperature is 100 and yesterday's temperature was 50, if you want to say the average temperature is 100, you can only factor in today. You can't factor in a single other day.
But I'm saying, though, that your new calculation would be your new average.
Yes, but that's because, again, that's
but
because
not the new normal.
You are only taking into account the period which already has your desired outcome.
Yes, I'm agreeing with you, though. I'm saying that...
It's totally circular logic.
Average and normal are actually two different things, and people often mix them up. And in this case, what they're actually talking about, I believe, is average temperature. They're not talking about normal.
I suppose. I've stopped caring.
Okay. Russian ATMs are taking banking security to a new level with questions such as, are you employed? And at this moment, do you have any other outstanding loans? The ATMs of Russia's biggest retail bank, Sberbank, will detect nervousness or emotional distress to decide whether or not to give you money.
Did you spend this morning drinking hydraulic fluid from your car?
The voice analysis system used in the machines was developed by the Speed Technology Center, a company whose other clients include the Federal Security Service, successor of the Soviet KGB. It should not come as a surprise that when law enforcement databases recorded voices of people found to be lying during police interrogations, that was used to design the software. The lie detector ATMs adhere to Russian privacy laws. Customers' voice signatures will be stored as prints on their credit card chips, and the bank will inform its customers about the new features. The global financial crisis and too many outstanding loans led the Russian bank to consider automating most banking activities, according to the senior vice president of technology. Deutsche Bank and Citigroup are among other banks now testing new technologies, although they are more interested in interactive displays and touchscreen terminals than lie detection technology.
Seriously, you got to imagine the Russians have just got that down pat, though. I mean, that's got to be a thing that the KGB didn't, I don't think they were necessarily troubled or bothered by most international standards or policies in terms of humanitarian treatment of suspected dissidents or political ne'er-do-wells. So I think they probably have a lot of technology laying around that they don't really have any use for, and they figure, hey, ATMs,
Yeah. I wish I could do like a really good Russian accent, because where they said that, you know, American companies, for example, might find the technology too intrusive, an executive with this Russian bank, whose name is Viktor Orlovsky, he said, "We are not climbing into the client's brain. We are just trying to find out if they are telling the truth."
Really? Did it sound? Wait, hold on a second. Did it sound anything like? Did it sound anything like this? Hold on. Let's see. Did it?
I expressly acknowledge and agree that use of the Apple software, as defined above, and services, as defined below, is at your sole risk, and that the entire risk as to satisfactory quality, performance, accuracy, and effort is with you.
We are not climbing into the customer's brains. All right.
We just want to know you are telling the truth.
Fantastic. There you go.
That's all the science.
Excellent. There you go. There's your Science on the March, brought to you by Squires Electric at 503-252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com. You can also find them at Facebook.com/SquiresElectric. All right, there you go. Proud sponsors of Science on the March. Don't forget, next hour, the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Today we'll talk to Mr. Big Jim Willig. He'll be here in the studio with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Today talking about Mr. John Candy. Also, is that in any way accurate?
That is completely and totally accurate.
Really? Another snuff watch?
We have another snuff watch.
And people are just dying every day. People be dying.
Women be shopping. People be dying.
Did I tell you that somebody tried to register womenbeshopping.com and it was already taken?
No. Really?
Yeah. Seamus tried to register womenbeshopping.com. It's totally taken. It's been taken for like 3 years.
Now, is shopping and shopping both?
Well, I don't think it works with shopping. I think it's got to be shopping. Snuff Watch, Geek Watch, Taser Watch, all coming up next hour on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. And the top five from December 8th, 1973. Here is Don Taylor.
Another piece of Albuquerque, New Mexico's memorabilia is gone. The Aztec Motel was once a booming tourist spot on Route 66, but is now being demolished. Historic preservation planner Ed Bull said that it's disappointing because when these folks bought the Aztec, we believed, and they believed, I think also, that they would be able to preserve it. So it's disappointing to see that they haven't been able to. The Aztec was built in 1932 and was one of the five most important motels left out of the nearly 100 that used to line the stretch between Albuquerque and Nob Hill on Route 66. Bull says, "I wonder about 50 years from now how many of these buildings will remain at all." The Aztec's owner said it would cost $1 million to restore it to its glory. His name is Jerry Landgraf, and he said, "Everything just kept falling apart to the point where we were spending more money to maintain it than we were getting any kind of income out of it."
I don't think I've ever been on Route 66. I mean, it makes me a bad American, I guess, because I've traveled through, because it goes through New Mexico, and it ends in California, doesn't it?
There's a whole song about it.
No, really?
Yeah, and it tells you all the towns.
It doesn't end in L.A., I don't think. I don't know where it is, but
it takes you to the Southern California area. It takes you, because, you can take it to the L.A. vicinity.
I think I've had the opportunity, but I think when I was driving from Utah to L.A., I was parallel to it at one point. I don't think I was actually on it. But there was this whole article that came out years and years ago in Newsweek about how just by dint of being on Route 66 or having property adjacent to it, like if you ran a restaurant or a hotel, it was automatically worth more because it had so much cultural cachet to it. But it's one of those places like the Sands that you would imagine you could just sort of make money just because you're there. And then if you can't, I guess you can't. But I mean, it surprises me that you can't turn that around into more of a revenue stream.
Well, a lot of Route 66 in that goes kind of in Southern California that goes like between states. A lot of it is it really is a true interstate. A lot of it is just in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing around. And I know that in California there was going out somewhere to visit somebody. I always wanted to stay. They had one of those motel complexes that each room like looked like a giant teepee.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to stay there. But the thing was, it was only like about an hour and 20 minutes away from where I lived.
So there was no point.
And it wasn't on the way to anywhere I wanted to go. You know, it's like, oh, well, go to Lancaster, you know, and buy some meth or go to the Air Force Base, because that's the only two things in Lancaster. You know, so it's a lot of these great motels are just sort of, they really are literally in the middle of nowhere.
Well, it's like that. There's like, I'm on the way to my hometown. There's this hotel that is I have no idea what it is or why it's there or if anybody actually stays there, but it's some, and you can't even, I don't even know how to get there. It's like as you're on, I guess, 395 or whatever, you see it as you're driving through, like, I don't know, like Umatilla. You can see it off to the left, removed from the highway, but it appears to be just in the middle of a huge field, and you can tell that it actually still functions because you'll see cars there. There's like a vending machine out front of the office or whatever, but there are no roads, and you can't quite tell how you would get there, and it's this two-level hotel, or a motel, I guess. No, if it's two levels, it's a hotel.
It can be a motel.
What's the difference?
I believe it's a single depth. Basically, if you can drive up and park right outside your
it's
room,
a motel.
It's a motel.
Okay, so it's a two-level motel, but it's obviously done in some like Wild West theme, you know, like some old, you know, like 1850s OK Corral type design, and it's got a big wagon wheel, you know, like out front of the office and everything, and sort of like a Western motif painted on the side, but it's all kind of peeling and fading away, like the you know, it's just like the mural in the back of an El Camino. It's just terrible. It just looks like the worst place on earth, and I kind of want to stay there at some point. But as I'm driving by, I always do the same thing. Yeah, we should stay there sometime, baby. Well, not this time, though. And then we just keep driving, and I know that I am contributing to the demise of that place. I am contributing to its implosion.
I feel that way every time I drive up to the Gorge or just to Washington, and I drive by, like, Tad's Chicken and Waffles.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, I want to go there, but not right now, or it's not open right now, or I didn't. Oh, we didn't plan for the time.
You know the place where you really ought to go, though?
I know someday it's going to go out of business, and I'm just going to kick myself that I never went there.
You're driving through the Gorge. You got to go to the Charburger. That's the place that people drive by.
I've been to the Charburger.
Charburger is freaking awesome. That's a thing that people are like, I always see that Charburger place. I never go in. I'm like, you got to go in.
Oh, no. They do it. They do a damn good burger.
And they have massive wedges of pie. And then also you can, if you sit near the window, you can actually sort of look out over the Gorge, and it appears as though, to some degree, as though you were just sort of hanging out over the huge chasm, like you were suspended in space.
Patrick took me there for the first time because whenever his family, that was like, they would have to drive between, like, Portland and wherever god-awful nowhere town his family's from in Washington, and they would always, that was part of the road trip.
The Charburger?
The whole family stopping at the Charburger.
Part of our road trip was going by, and then the family making embarrassing and degrading Indian calls in the car. Because there's a quaint little Indian maiden out front with a single feather.
Yes, there is.
She's got the headband and one feather, and like her name is, I don't know, Polly Blackfoot or something. It's all very embarrassing.
The state of Alaska is scheduled today to release more than 24,000 pages of Sarah Palin's emails from her first 2 years as governor, providing a fresh glimpse into how she led the state as she rose to become a player on the national political stage. The emails were first requested during the 2008 White House race by citizens and news organizations, including the Associated Press, as they vetted a vice presidential nominee whose political experience included less than one term as governor of Alaska and a term of a mayor in the small town of Wasilla. The nearly three-year delay has been attributed largely to the sheer volume of the release and the flood of requests. Alaska is releasing the thousands of emails in paper form only and asking news organizations to pick up several boxes worth of documents in Alaska's capital city, which is accessible only by air or water.
That's wonderful.
Reporters from several news organizations have already begun arriving in Juneau and are making various plans to disseminate the emails to the public.
They're stored in the same filing cabinet right next to the plans to renovate Arthur Dent's house.
Oh, you can have them, they said. But we're not going to make it easy for you. Palin told Fox News on Sunday that she was unfazed by the release of emails, saying there are no more rocks that could be turned over about her life or time as governor. But she also said a lot of those emails obviously weren't meant for public consumption, and that she expects people might take some of the messages out of context.
Well, I think it was, I forget who, it might be... Might be the Huffington Post or somebody, or that is actually, they're trying to recruit sort of just people, just not unlike how the SETI program actually recruited a lot of desktop computer users to have their screensavers analyze bits of data that we've got, that we've received from like pulsars or quasars or something. They've tried to recruit a whole bunch of people to each read a page of emails. And they're like, if we can get like 15,000 people and everybody agrees to read one page, then we can get these all read in like a day. And then they can just sort of highlight or flag anything sort of interesting and send it our way or whatever, which is, you got to admire that, though. I don't think you were here. I think it was when you were gone on Wednesday and Snyder was here. They were talking about how the Vatican had all these child abuse documents, but that, like, they're not really able to turn them over right now because they're all in the original Latin, and they just, the Vatican just can't find anybody to translate the Latin documents. So, unfortunately, they won't be able to be submitted into court as evidence. So you've almost got to admire that, and it's just willful obstinance.
And in other Sarah Palin news, Steve Bannon's documentary, The Undefeated, is sort of
being released.
Oh,
that's the Palin thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
His pro-Sarah Palin documentary. They announced with pride that the movie is going to launch exclusively at select AMC theaters. The film will launch, and this is from the announcement, the film will launch in markets such as Dallas, Denver, Oklahoma City, Orlando, Atlanta, Orange County, Phoenix, Houston, Indianapolis, and Kansas City. So basically, what they've done is he couldn't get any kind of a wide release for the movie. They've managed to book some AMC theaters all in red state areas.
I can't imagine it would be to any benefit for them to book it here anyway, though. I mean, it's like, it seems like it would just be throwing money away if you tried to get it booked in Portland, because, like, who's going to go see that? And who's going to go see it and not just jeer at it?
Yeah.
I mean, that is just, I think, maximizing one's resources. You know what's fascinating? If you read an article about that guy, and apparently is a man of some means, and they gave him... I guess they gave him kind of carte blanche to make the film, but he's just such a freakish Palin supporter. He's like one of those George Soros guys, but for the right. And so I guess he just made this, like, two-hour, just, like, huge wet kiss of a love letter to Sarah Palin. But from just a little bit of it I've seen, and I haven't seen a lot of it, but it does seem very much to be... Because, the thing that the right has never quite been able to come up with, the right's never, except for Rush Limbaugh, the right has never been able to come up with kind of their own Michael Moore. And Rush actually predates Michael Moore
This guy desperately wants that. I heard him on NPR this morning, either last night or this morning, I can't remember when it was, but he was talking about, and he kept talking about Fahrenheit, 9/11. And,
right.
And he's trying to position himself as, like, a conservative Michael Moore. And then he also keeps saying that the movie is not pro-Sarah Palin in any way whatsoever, but then in the next breath, he'll talk about what's actually in the movie, and it's painfully obvious that, yes, it's a huge pro-Sarah Palin, basically kind of a propaganda piece, kind of like a 90-minute version of that half-hour... that half-hour infomercial that Obama did when he was running for president.
Oh, I forgot all about that. Oh, that was wonderful. The one section of the film that I saw was that he actually, and he did a pretty good job of this, actually, where the guy, and I forget his name, but he the great thing about the internet is the internet just gives you so much material that no matter what you are looking for, you can, doesn't matter how bizarre or weird or specific it is, you can find a representative sampling of, like, anything. And so he has this whole montage of people, many of them, to be fair, comedians, so it's not like they're there to give you balanced political insight anyway, but he has this whole montage of people saying really horrific, like, awful, terrible, often sexual or sexist things, like Louis C.K., for example, about Sarah Palin. And so if you watch the montage, I mean, even if you go into it kind of knowing that it's propaganda and knowing that it's all just sort of a scam, if you didn't know any better, you kind of come off the other side going, wow, she really has been unfairly maligned. Because if you string together enough people saying that, saying something awful and horrible about her, specifically seizing on some sexual aspect of her, I mean, that accomplishes what that guy is certainly, I mean, for his purposes, I would imagine it's probably going to seal the deal. I wish that it would play here only because I want to see it, because it's fascinating to me when those things are done well.
Well, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see that if after this gets release in theaters and then it's done being in theaters, if after that Palin actually does announce that she wants to run for president, because she's been traveling around on this bus tour, but she keeps saying that it's not a campaign
right thing.
And the thing is that when Citizens United tried to distribute Hillary the movie a couple of years ago, that inspired a Supreme Court case that kind of, erased a whole bunch of the FEC problems about releasing a movie about a potential candidate. So if this movie comes out and it actually gets, like, some traction, it'll be interesting to see now, since there's not those same, requirements that it not be about an actual running candidate if she decides to.
It's going to be a great year, Don.
Yeah.
It really is.
We got to get that Palin watch, because she's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah, I'm working on it. Just nothing seems to, you know, she defies any sort of summation musically. I mean, we've tried over and over on the Rick Emerson Show to create a Palin watch theme, and it just doesn't really work. Next time, by the way, on the Rick Emerson Show, Snuff Watch, Geek Watch, Taser Watch, Jim Willig here with Humor Me, Comedy 101, and the top five. Here is Don Taylor.
How about Kenny Rogers' Lady?
No.
Okay. Let's do our entertainment news.
Excellent. Here's your entertainment news for Friday on the Legion of News.
Game of Thrones star and one of my TV crushes, Game of Thrones star Peter Dinklage and his wife Erica Schmidt are expecting their first child, according to Us Weekly. The 41-year-old also starred in The Station Agent in Bruges and the FX series Nip Tuck. Mel Gibson completed his community service sentence, which originated from a plea deal he reached in March concerning a domestic violence charge. Gibson fulfilled his service on Wednesday after he traveled to Guatemala and worked with Mending Kids International. Under the plea deal, Gibson amassed 3 years probation, 52 weeks of counseling, 16 hours of community service, and nearly $600 in fines.
Okay.
Planet of the Apes and the cooler actress, Estella Warren, was charged yesterday in Los Angeles with hit-and-run driving, battering on an officer, resisting arrest, and DUI. The charges originate from Warren's alleged drunk driving accident last month, in which she drove her Toyota Prius into three cars and left the scene. After getting arrested, the 32-year-old tried to make a getaway from the police station, but was apprehended. She's out on $100,000 bail and faces up to 2.5 years in prison if she's convicted. Robin Wright is in talks to star with Kevin Spacey in the TV series House of Cards, which is based on the British miniseries of the same name. The show will be Netflix's first original series, and the Social Network filmmaker David Fincher will direct the pilot.
By the way, I've been watching the BBC House of Cards, which is just great. I mean, it's just fantastic. Wow. It's really, really good. That was the thing. So I would, when this story first came out, Siegfried was actually the one who told me about it, because he's like, dude, if you haven't seen the BBC series House of Cards, you've got to watch it. House of Cards was, I think it ran for two full seasons or series in Britain, and then an abbreviated third. And it is as though he described it as sort of being an inversion of the West Wing, as though if you can imagine a West Wing in which Jed Bartlett were a villain, that it sort of tracks one man's ascendance from low-level cabinet post all the way to being the Prime Minister of Britain, and through political machinations and manipulations and showing exactly how he molds the system to work for him, and how a totally corrupt and venal individual becomes Prime Minister of Britain. And the great thing about the series is the guy is just so unbelievably evil, but one of the devices they introduce early on is that he turns and talks to the camera. He does the whole break in the fourth wall thing. And it's a whole lot of like, well, then we'll see exactly how this can accrue to my benefit, won't we? And then like a guy comes into his office and you see him sort of putting his plan into it. It's if the American
version
is
Kevin Spacey doing this, that could either be awesome or just horrible.
Yeah, but David Fincher, though.
You can go either way with Kevin Spacey.
Fincher doesn't, you know, I mean, really, you know, you can count on very few fingers the number of just bad projects David Fincher's made, so.
Dancing with the Stars runner-up Kirstie Alley said she's paying $41,000 in property taxes on her Tampa, Florida mansion, and she described her delinquency as an oversight. A spokesman released a statement on the matter saying initially Alley was not aware of the amount owed, and her accountant never received a bill.
That seems implausible.
It does. I don't buy it.
No.
Rapper Flo Rida was arrested yesterday in Miami Beach.
He wants you to help whip Mr. Tooth Decay.
He was charged with DUI and driving with a suspended license. The rapper, whose real name is Trauma LaSalle Dillard, was pulled over by authorities and given a sobriety test. A spokesperson for the Miami Police Department said his blood alcohol level was 185.
I guess Dillard is the name that I would drop there. What's his real name? Trauma LaSalle?
Trauma LaSalle.
I would totally go with that. That sounds like that's a fantastic name.
Yeah. Flo Rida.
Flo Rida sounds like some sort of a... It sounds like a potato product that cures cavities.
And MTV has canceled their series Skins.
My wife will be very upset.
They issued the following statement. Skins is a global television phenomenon that unfortunately didn't connect with a U.S. audience as much as we hoped. We admire the work the series creator Brian Isley did in adapting the show for MTV, and appreciate the core audience that embraced it.
I guess
I'd seen the I saw several episodes of the British.
Maybe she watches the British one. Maybe it's not the American
one. Really good, but I just couldn't. I couldn't imagine it translating to American TV.
The British one is it's skeezy. I mean, it's like a whole lot of just spotty, greasy children humping it out. It made me feel. I mean, I suppose it was good and all, but it was just sort of creepy to watch.
Yeah,
I never saw the American one.
Yeah, I didn't either, but I just couldn't imagine it working.
Do you remember that show that MTV aired back in the, I guess it would have been the late 90s, early 2000s? Do you remember a show called Undressed?
Yes.
It was a sort of, it was a soap opera.
Vaguely,
it was a soap opera made for MTV, and I seem to be one of the, so you would be like the second person I found who actually remembers it. It was like one of those things that apparently was on for such a short period of time that only I saw it. And it was this weird ongoing soap opera that I think was half an hour in length and starred a bunch of, sort of pretty people. And it took place always at night, like in a dorm room or something. It was all very weird. I actually want to go back and watch it again because it was sort of an intriguing show. And then I went back to watch it and it was just gone. So we have 3 seconds here. Do you have anything interesting?
No.
All right, too late. All right. And with that, we bring down the curtain on another exciting episode of Legion of News. By the way, in case you're wondering, womenbeshopping.com, that's with a G at the end. That's a woman's blog. She's, quote, a fantasy illustrator who recently became a feminist, and these are my wacky hijinks.
Ooh, I like wacky hijinks.
Her recent article is about how this year she acquired thin privilege.
Okay, I don't like her now.
Also, there's a whole category on her blog called rape culture.
Okay, I really don't like her now.
Okay, there you go. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious Southeast Portland at the news desk. Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer, Bruce Eichel, chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa. Have a safe and satisfying weekend. We'll see you Monday for Legion of News. Thank you and good day.